Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
985 days, 12 hours, 54 minutes, 38 seconds, 35 seconds, 33 seconds, until George W. Bush leaves office, assuming it's done voluntarily, that is, barring impeachment. Welcome to our program today. Bird flu. Boy, did you see the ABC program last night? That was mind-boggler. I forget the title of the thing, but it was like, you know, the modern version of Outbreak. And, of course, Tal Afar, the city that George W. Bush has touted as a great success story. 17 people killed, 35 wounded in a suicide bombing in Tal Afar, the news out of Iraq this morning. We'll be coming back to that and a whole lot of other stuff. There's a lot going on in the news today. In just a moment. First, Sam Kasman is with us. Sam is the general counsel of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, and head CEI's Death by Regulation Project. Hey, good morning, Sam.
Hi, good morning.
Or good afternoon, I guess, if you're on the East Coast. This Public Citizen, the organization that Ralph Nader started way back when, notes that drug industry lobbyists, this is in a report from 3 days ago, drug industry lobbyists conspired with the White House and Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist last year to craft a sweeping liability provision that shields the industry from lawsuits over products used, even in cases of gross negligence or gross recklessness, according to a report issued today by Public Citizen. And then they go through and they document how all of these pharmacy lobbyists, 158 lobbyists from the pharmacy industry were involved in this thing. And it had Frist and Hastert inserting provisions in a conference report and in legislation in the Defense Appropriations Bill in the dead of night. People didn't even know about it until after the thing had been voted on. Congress was given less than 3 hours to vote on a multi-hundred-page bill in the House of Representatives. Doesn't this say that we have a fundamental problem with the corruption of the Food and Drug Administration by corporate interests in the United States?
Well, I think politics is a very messy and dirty game, but I think the biggest problem when it comes to FDA is the fact that it suffers from what we call deadly overcaution. That is, it is much more concerned about the possibility of a drug that it approves later having unanticipated side effects, which is a big concern, but it's not the only one. What it does not give enough attention to is the fact that when needed drugs are kept off the market because FDA wants to make sure they're 100% safe, that means people are denied therapies. And so even though there are cases like Vioxx, which is questionable, where people really wonder should this drug ever have been out there, but I got to say it's questionable.
It's only 30,000, 40,000 people dead. I mean,
well, that depends whose number.
We get all hysterical about 3,000 people on 9/11.
You have to remember that an FDA advisory committee, after it was yanked from the market, an FDA advisory committee said, well, it really ought to be staying back on the market. But let me give you another case. There's a drug called Tysabri, which went into clinical trials about 2 years back. It turned out to be more than twice as effective as the next best drug, which is something involving interferon, for multiple sclerosis, which is largely untreatable. It was pulled from the market after three people out of several thousand developed a very serious side effect, even though you had hundreds of MS sufferers who would love to get their hands on that drug. Now, it's been resubmitted. Right now, it is waiting for FDA to approve it. We suspect FDA is not going to do anything until June, even though back in January, an advisory board said, get this out there. This is an example of what happens with what we call deadly overcaution.
Now, you're talking about these advisory committees for the FDA. This from a news release from 2 weeks ago from Public Citizen. During this period, they're looking at the years 2001 to 2004 when there's records available. And this, by the way, is from a study that appeared in the April 26, 2006 issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association. During this period, 28% of FDA advisory committee members and voting consultants had a conflict of interest. That is, they were making money from the drug companies. At the same time, they're on the FDA committee that decides what drugs go on. One member or consultant had a conflict in 73% of all meetings. Despite this, only 1% of members ever recused themselves from attending the meetings. So these advisory committees seem like they're already badly corrupted by industry. Could that be why the advisory committee says, hey, Vioxx isn't such a big deal?
It depends what you call corruption, because the fact that, you know, if you're experienced in treating a disease, the chances are at some point down the line in your professional career, you will have done consulting for a drug company. If you think that that sort of alleged conflict rules you out of...
That's not the kind of conflict they're talking about here. They're talking about people who are actually in real time, at the same time they're on the FDA committee, receiving money from the pharmaceutical companies.
No, frankly, I've been to doctors treating me for a nail fungus who have been in these alleged conflicts with companies sponsoring the stuff. I still trust them to treat me as opposed to some federal bureaucrat. Public Citizen is run by Dr. Sidney Wolf. And, you know, he's entitled to practice his own course of medicine, but bear in mind that just because a drug is approved does not mean anyone has to use it. If it has not been approved by FDA, that means no one can use it. And so for this very reason, you've got drugs like Tysabri, which could be helping thousands of MS sufferers, and it's going to be taking a while for FDA to let it out because they are scared. They are scared to death of another adverse side effect. The best guarantee of zero adverse side effects are zero new drugs. But frankly, from the standpoint of public health, that is one surefire disaster.
And nobody's recommending that. But the Journal of the American Medical Association, two weeks ago, said...
Sidney Wolf has got a huge book, what he calls, good pills, bad pills.
I know.
There's a lot of therapies out there he does not like.
And that's not what you and I are discussing right now, Sam.
No, but
we're talking about whether or not the FDA should be regulating this stuff and to what extent.
Let me just toss this out.
You had your say. Give me a chance to rebut this, please. This from the Journal of the American Medical Association, from their piece 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. If a juror is found in a jury trial, if a juror is found to have so much as read a newspaper, he or she can be dismissed in certain trials. We should have zero tolerance for accepting levels of conflict of interest that have even small impact upon voting outcome, but in our study we found such impacts. You're saying that you have no problem with the corruption of the FDA by big pharmaceutical companies, but I'm assuming you wouldn't want that kind of corruption going on if you were in a criminal trial.
Well, look, if you want to hold FDA to the level of jurors in a criminal trial, we will have exactly the scenario I'm suggesting.
Well, in a criminal trial, somebody might go to jail. With the FDA, somebody might die.
Where nothing gets approved, and the far bigger risk that FDA, whether you regard it as corrupt or just, you know, influenced or whatever, the far bigger risk that FDA poses to the public is not for the drugs that it lets through, but for the drugs that it delays. If
so
it's going to
let me
approve
get this straight,
something
Sam.
That's going to save lives tomorrow, that means people are
let
dying
me, let
today.
Me get this straight. You're saying that if all the people on the FDA panels who are approving drugs don't have a conflict of interest with the pharmaceutical industry, that is, they're not making money from the drug industry, that therefore they will never approve drugs?
No, I'm saying you're going to find very few qualified people to put on those advisory boards.
Well,
and so maybe the system is to do away with the entire notion that FDA should have a veto power here. Let me give you my suggestion, which is relatively simple. Don't abolish FDA and don't even change its standards for drug safety and effectiveness. Just take away its veto power and let unapproved drugs be available under medical supervision with very clear warning that they are unapproved. Now, this might sound off the wall to you, but we've done polls of oncologists, cardiologists, neurologists, all of whom end up actually favoring that sort of approach.
But people can get in those kind of trials right now. My father is suffering from cancer. There's an experimental drug available. His oncologist said, I can get you into one of these trials. This drug is not approved.
You've got to be relatively lucky. If you want to get into one of those trials, you have to be lucky in terms of what doctor you've got. Is he willing to do the paperwork?
It's already out there.
There are lots of people who cannot get into those
trials. Isn't what you're suggesting, Sam Kasman, with CEI.org, Competitive Enterprise Institute, isn't what you're suggesting basically, let's just turn this over to the corporations? It's essentially the same thing as saying, we're going to have laws against bank robbery, but the police, they don't have the power to actually put anybody in jail for it. It's just we're going to have the law.
No, look, under my system, if any company is engaged in fraud, hang it. But I'm saying that doctors are in a much better position to make decisions regarding new therapies than FDA is. To the extent you think FDA is really corrupt here, that's all the more reason, I'd say, to go with what I'm suggesting.
In other words, the pharmaceutical corporations have corrupted the FDA. Therefore, we should take away the power of the FDA. Why not take away the power of the pharmaceutical companies?
how do you propose to do that? To have the post office develop our new drugs?
I think that the federal government should be funding more of this research rather than the pharmaceutical companies. And
look,
in fact,
we
actually do pay for an awful lot of it through our research universities, but the pharmaceutical companies walk away with the profits.
Well, they walk away with whatever profits they can bargain. But the notion of turning drug development into a public enterprise, as opposed to...
I'm not talking about development. I'm talking about clinical trials.
Yeah, that's the actual development of new drugs. I mean, NIH does a lot of good work when it comes to basic research. When it comes to developing new stuff, they are pretty bad. And I still think, really, the end result you get here is something that looks like the post office. And frankly, they're the last people in the world I would want to put in charge of our medical future.
But okay, we're out of time. 16 minutes past the hour. Sam Kasman, Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Sam, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
16
Bye.
Minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
This here's a land of plenty, and plenty's what it takes to get some health insurance in these old United States. I just know I shouldn't have to go bankrupt or on the street if the cancer comes a-calling, as it might for you or me. I ran into my congressman, said, "Your Honorable, would you mind taking 20 minutes, if you ever find the time, to figure out some health care that would work as good for me as what you fellas got yourself in Washington, D.C. So if you get appendicitis or a splinter in your hand, I hope you're in New Zealand, Libya, or Switzerland, or somewhere else where they have somehow figured out a way to keep you upright till the good Lord says that it's your day."
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 22 minutes past the hour. And, it's kind of funny. The folks who say, "Oh, you wouldn't want the post office to be running your pharmaceuticals." In other words, you wouldn't want a government bureaucracy. I have no problem with the post office putting people to death. You know, yes, let's have capital punishment in the United States. It's a government bureaucracy. Right. Ah, no problem there. Actually, I can't speak for Sam Kasman. I don't know his position on capital punishment, but it is so often the case. It's just the default line of the post. I'm sorry. The post office, in my opinion, is actually pretty well run. I'm very happy with the post office. I get my mail, and other people get mail that I send to them. I mean, that's more than you can say for a lot of things, a lot of countries. I'm just generally fairly happy with it. Will in Las Vegas, Nevada on the line. Hey, Will, what's on your mind today?
Tutela, how you doing, man?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Will?
Way cool. I just thought I'd put a comparison up for you, man. I just took Amtrak across the country a couple weeks back. Had no security whatsoever on the train, man. I've been noticing these commercials and all this great stuff they're doing to protect everybody since, 9/11. But there was no security whatsoever on the train, man. Somebody pulled a knife on me. I kicked his ass real quick and then found out what was going on the train since there was no security around. She says, almost ready to retire lady. She's been with the company forever. She says, "Yeah, there used to be 3 people for 3 cars. Then 7 years ago, there was 2 people for 3 cars. Now there's me. And security, too, man." And,
wow. So it's like the this is part of the Star of the Beast strategy, the Republicans. They don't like Amtrak. They don't like public transportation. And so, they cut back funding and cut back funding and cut back funding to the point where, bingo.
They dropped the line across from California to Vegas 5 years ago. That's kind of an interesting number. It's totally worthless.
Yeah, I got it, Will. I got it. Thank you very much for the call. Nate in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hey, Nate.
Hey, I was just going to say that I don't think I'd like to ask you. I have MS, and I would have liked to have asked your guest there what his stance is on medical marijuana, because he sounds so willing to take a chance on this supposed miracle drug, but the drug that all MS people say helps the most, which is marijuana. he won't even, he probably wouldn't be willing to take such, I just have a feeling that he'd be
faced
about.
We don't know. And you know, it'd be legitimate to ask him. He's gone, though, but good point. And in fact, we have a friend back in Vermont with MS, and medical marijuana works very well for her and has for a number of years. So.
Yeah, and I know that it does, too. And I know also how much these MS drugs cost. And another thing that's funny about the MS drugs is why it's kind of ironic that the side effects for the MS drugs are a lot the same as the as the symptoms of the MS. So then, say that your symptoms they're side effects. They're not. So then they can say that the drugs are working better because you don't have MS symptoms. You just have side effects from the drug, which isn't so bad.
Oh, is that strange? That is strange.
Yeah, you should look into that.
You have personal knowledge of this? I mean, personal experience with this?
Yeah, I have MS.
Yeah.
And that's what I've been told, and I've been to all the experts, and I know that I'm just so weak and tired, my muscles are just falling apart, my vision's going.
I'm sorry.
But I don't want to. I just thought I'd tell you that so you could. And then if you should also look into the profit margins. I heard you talk about that one time on the what it costs to make a drug versus what they sell it for. For those MS ones, I think that people pay like upwards of $10,000 a year, or their insurance companies pay for some of those shots.
Well, and in fact, on the front page of the marketplace section of the Wall Street Journal today, the headline, this is the top story on page B1, wary of backlash, cancer drug makers weigh price limits. As high prices of cancer drugs spark the kind of patient outrage that high AIDS drug prices unleashed more than a decade ago, a few pharmaceutical and biotech companies are weighing caps and other cost containment measures before the outcry turns into a public relations crisis for the industry. In other words, and they're talking about, like, for example, Erbutix, which is a drug for colorectal cancer, $10,000 it costs per month for therapy with this stuff. It's from ImClone Bristol Myers. Another drug, Revlimid, for you can tell I'm not a physician. Myelodysplastic syndrome, from Colgene, $4,600 a month. Avastin, colorectal, Genentech, $4,400 a month. And people saying, "Hey, wait a minute." You know, and you see the pharmaceutical industry, one of the wealthiest and most powerful industries in the world, not just in the United States, in the world. And I mean, they're right up there with the oil industry and with the food industry. It's just because drugs are very profitable. Nate, thanks a lot for the call. It's good to hear from you. I also want to get back to this thing about yesterday. We were talking about how many babies die in the United States. A little follow up on that, and we'll continue with this topic. Also, I want to get into Ahmadinejad's letter. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I believe in love and I live my life accordingly. But I choose to let the mystery be. Everybody's wondering what and where it all came from. Everybody's wondering about where they're going to go.
And right, welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour, coming up on 25 before.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yes, what the right wing is up to, you hear it here before you have to hear it on Right Wing Talk Radio. The Republican National Committee sent this out to all the talk show hosts all across America this morning. This is really remarkable when you consider it. The Republicans are looking, they're spoiling for a fight, right? They're absolutely spoiling for a fight with regard to federal judges because they think that this is going to help them, number one. But number two, if Karl Rove is indicted in Washington, D.C. and appeals, it will be heard by the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C. That's the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. This is also, by the way, the court that is, it's the First Circuit. It's also the court that most often sends its members to the U.S. Supreme Court. So, Karl Rove and the White House have orchestrated this thing to put Brett Kavanaugh on the District Court of Appeals, the court that would hear the case of Karl Rove should he decide to appeal, should he be convicted. Kavanaugh has no judicial experience. This guy has never been a judge, and they want to put him in the second highest court in the United States. He was an associate counsel. That's like an assistant attorney on Ken Starr's case for impeaching Bill Clinton. He worked on the investigation of Vince Foster's suicide. You know, where all the right-wingers are running around going, Hillary's got something to do with this. We know it. We just know it. When Bill Clinton tried to assert executive privilege with regard to Monica, Brett Kavanaugh was out there saying, he has executive privilege. He doesn't have executive privilege. There's no such thing. Well, now he's the White House counsel and assistant to the president. Excuse me, associate White House guy. He's the assistant to the lawyer of the president. And he now is a big champion of executive privilege. Well, here's what the Republicans sent out, the Republican National Committee. The real Dem agenda, higher taxes, impeachment, cut and run, obstruction. Next up on the real Dem agenda, obstruction. Democrats and Liberal American Bar Association team up to obstruct highly qualified judicial nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The Republicans all have their panties in a wad over the fact that the American Bar Association, yes, that liberal organization, the American Bar Association, this isn't the trial lawyers, this is the ABA, have downgraded their qualification rating of this guy. And you got folks like Harry Reid saying he hasn't decided whether he's going to vote for this guy or not. So the Republicans are coming out swinging. They quote Charlie Schumer, Senator Chuck Schumer. If ever there was a right-wing political fight that needed an ideological soldier, Brett Kavanaugh was there. Ted Kennedy, much of Kavanaugh's public service has been in the current Bush White House, where his duties included recommending some of the president's most bitterly divisive judicial nominees. Patrick Leahy, the Democratic senator from Vermont, chairman, number two guy on the Senate Judiciary Committee. This hearing gives this young man another chance to show his independence. Unless he demonstrates the capacity, I will oppose this nomination. Dianne Feinstein, this is a difficult nomination. And after rating Brett Kavanaugh well-qualified two previous times, the American Bar Association recently downgraded his rating to provide ammunition to Democrats, is what the Republican National Committee says. Yes, provide. I'm sure. So the Republicans are all hysterical about this. They're trying to make it like, those liberals, they're trying to stop good judges. Really all it's about is don't want Karl Rove to have his handpicked judge sitting on the court that he may well appear before. And not just Karl Rove. Scooter Libby may end up there. George Bush may end up there. Dick Cheney may end up there. Yeah, who knows? I mean, the list might go on. Porter Goss might end up there. Mr. Fago may end up. I mean, it's just, the Dusty Fago. The list just goes on and on and on. Just to wrap up the medical section of our discussion here, we started out the hour with. Yesterday on this program, might have been the second or third hour of the show, I talked about the State of the Mothers, State of the World's Mothers study that was just published by Save the Children. And they noted that the United States was next to the last in developed countries in terms of infant deaths. We were number two, just above, as I recall, Slovenia or something like that. And the report notes that 10 countries account for more than two-thirds of all newborn deaths worldwide. Well, that's the other end of the spectrum. In any case, I went through that. I talked about it on the air. And I got an email from somebody who says, well, actually, the U.S. does have a high infant mortality rate, but it's not because of our deplorable health care system. She says, number one, docs in the U.S. try to save extremely small preemies who are counted as stillbirths in other countries. So our stats are different. There's apples and orange problem. And number two, we do a lot of in vitro fertilization, which produces multiple births, which produces small and premature infants, which produces more infant deaths. So there's that. Plus, there's the fact, as was pointed out in the study, that African Americans in the United States have just about twice the infant death rate of non-African Americans in the United States. So there's a whole bunch of things that are skewing these factors. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Pat in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, rather. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Happy Mother's Day to Louise coming up.
Well, thank you. She's listening, so I'm sure she's smiling right now.
Very good. One thing I'd like to remind people is that they can grow their own fruits and vegetables and eat healthier, and therefore getting rid of some of the processed foods out of their lives and getting rid of some of the pesticides and chemicals that are in processed foods.
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, increasingly, people are just basically shopping in the organic store, you know, the health food store, the local co-op. Or what we're seeing in a lot of places, we were seeing this in Vermont, and we're noticing it here in Portland, Oregon, since we've moved out here to Little Beirut, as George Bush Sr. used to say, is that the regular supermarkets, Fred Meyer's is a big chain out here, and, you know, sort of like Safeway kind of thing, and they have a huge organic section, and in the, just among their vegetables, they'll have, you know, apples and organic apples, oranges, organic oranges. And so, you know, you can make your choice.
It can be a great hobby, too, to have a greenhouse or grow fruits and vegetables by hydroponics.
Yeah.
I don't know too much about that, but a little bit, and it sounds like it'd be great fun and quite a feeling of accomplishment to do something like that.
Yep, or just put some dirt in the ground and turn it over and put some plants in it. Pat, got to move along. Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate your kind comments. John in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. Yeah, I've done reading on, you know, the cost of health care solutions, way to bring it down, and some of the obstacles that are in the health care is administered between doctors and pharmaceutical companies and patients that is kind of self-defeating and drives up prices, and that it's a systemic problem. Read about how a lot of procedures and a lot of testing which does not need a doctor can and should be broken away from having to be done by a doctor, meaning that they by setting up independent clinics that could do a lot of smaller stuff that people can pay for out of pocket more easily and more cheaply than having.
Well, in fact, we do have, you know, nurses now. There are a lot of nurses, nurse practitioners, who can actually prescribe drugs and are doing things that doctors used to do. I would say, John, rather than saying let's have less qualified people doing more of these procedures, why don't we do away with the anti-monopoly exemption that the American Medical Association has, and simply say as much demand as there is for doctor schools that people can get into them? I mean, right now the AMA has a cap on the number of doctors they will allow to graduate or come into the United States every year, and they do this in order to keep doctor salaries up. In most of the rest of the world, doctors are paid what, you know, the equivalent in today's dollars in the U.S. of maybe somewhere between $60,000 and $100,000 a year. You know, the high end, the extreme high end of middle class, but not, you know, $500,000 or $1 million a year some oncologists make in the United States, some surgeons make in the United States. And the reason why these physicians are making this much money in the United States is simply because the AMA controls the supply of them. And the downside consequence of that is, number one, less physician care available to customers. And number two, more people going into medicine who are going into it not because they're passionate about healing people, but because they're passionate about making money.
Well, I mean, the thing about a clinic, though, that is a way of kind of breaking up the monopoly. They've said that a lot of these procedures.
No, I'm not disagreeing with you, John. I'm not disagreeing with you. Yeah, and there are some, and I'm not blowing out your idea. I'm just saying I think that there's a whole bunch of systemic problems in our healthcare system, and you've identified one, and I think I just identified one. Rick in Grand Rapids. Hey, Rick, we have about a half a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
Well, I just wanted to speak about the Michael Hayden nomination that one of the most vociferous critics has been Mr. Hoekstra from West Michigan in my part of the country here.
Yes, the Republican congressman.
But yet he's from the House, and the House will not have any input on this nomination because the Senate, am I too conspiracy-minded to think that maybe the White House is giving the House Republicans a passing? Oh, criticize all you want, because guess what? You can't vote on it anyway.
Well, I think that I've been saying this for a few months on this program. I think that the White House is going to be coordinating attacks on Bush by Republicans in the House who are up for re-election, because all of them are up for re-election right now, because their fear is that if they lose control of the House of Representatives, Bush will be impeached, and Bush and Cheney may actually face prosecution, criminal prosecution, for the things they've done. And certainly Karl Rove will face criminal prosecution, and these guys want to hang on to power to prevent the possibility of impeachment.
But, of course, Bush and Cheney could be indicted by the criminal system once they leave office, correct?
Yeah, but that's usually not done. Usually we just say, okay, that's behind us now, let's move forward. And most presidents don't want to get involved in prosecuting former presidents. It's really bad form. So what Bush and Cheney really have to worry about is impeachment.
Gentlemen's agreement, huh?
Yeah, well, more or less, yeah. It's actually, I'd say it's probably political wisdom. I mean, even the opposite. But it just has never happened. You look back in the history of the United States, and there's certainly been a lot of crooks in office. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. It's 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Friends, 9 minutes before the hour, Abraham Lincoln, our quote for the day, the probability that we may fail in the struggle ought not to deter us from the support of a cause we believe to be just. Coming up on today's program, by the way, at the beginning of the next hour, Jeffrey Feldman, editor-in-chief of Frame Shop Is Open, will be with us. The, in my opinion, one of the leading experts in the United States on framing, on that neuro-linguistic programming, NLP technique for redefining reality that the Republicans are so good at, pointing out what the Republican frames are and what the Democratic frames should be. We're also going to have a Taking Back Our Country, Taking Our Country Back segment. Rich Whitney, the candidate for governor of Illinois, running on the green ticket, will be with us. WhitneyForGov.org, his website. He'll be with us at the bottom of the next hour. And in the third hour of our program, Larry Scott is going to drop by and visit us. He's the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, and one of the finest organizations in the country looking out for what's up with vets. In the midst of all that, I want to get to the Iranian president's letter, this letter from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. This is a very thoughtful letter. I mean, I have read this. I've read the entire thing, and we don't have time now. We've got a few more calls here to wrap up this hour. But in the next hour or the third hour of the program, I want to share with you some chunks from this thing, and because I can understand why Bush did not want this letter to be public, why Bush doesn't want attention drawn to it, and why Bush would just as soon not talk about it, because Ahmadinejad is basically saying to him, "Hey, you're a Christian. I'm a Muslim. We're both devout guys. Let's talk about what that means." See, he's making the, in my opinion, mistaken assumption that Bush actually understands the teachings of Jesus. Anyhow, Patricia in Sacramento, California, KSAC. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Tom, yesterday I came across a conservative radio station. They were bringing up the subject of here in California, the state workers are threatening to go on strike unless they get a 4% raise.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get your perspective on it, because the debate is whether or not government employees should be able to strike. And the second one is what constitutes a raise for government employees. My thing has always been your income or your wages should be based on the cost of living. I mean,
yes.
If the cost of living goes up, your wages should be able to go up with that. Now, do you see that that's any different for government employees? And I wanted to get your opinion on whether you believe they should go on strike.
Well, the whipping boys of today for the right wing are anybody unionized, and most of our unionized employees, I'm not sure if it's most of them, but a good chunk of the unionized employees left in the United States are government employees, whether it's teachers or whether it's just, you know, other government employees. And so, of course, they want to go after them, and they want to make them, you know, portray them as people who are greedy and how dare they ask for a raise and all that kind of thing. Certainly, I think that everybody should be getting raises that reflect inflation, because inflation is something that our government does to us for very specific reasons that benefit the very wealthy and benefit government. They get to borrow money and pay it off with money that's worth less, literally. And you know, 4% doesn't seem unreasonable right now. It seems to me that that's at the very... You know, I mean, since Bush came into office, the cost of gasoline has gone up 120%. Cost of health care has gone up some 70-80%. You look at the costs of, you know, food is up, everything is up. 4% is nothing, number one. Number two, should government employees be allowed to strike? Why not?
Yep.
I mean, you know, why not? In France, I mean, we actually have laws in this country that says that there are some, you know, essential service employees that cannot strike, for example, air traffic controllers. So when PATCO went out on strike, Reagan just fired them, and he had the legal authority to do that. It's arguable you know, whether he should even have that authority. Because the bottom line is, if the government or anybody else isn't negotiating in good faith with strikers, with labor, the only tool that labor has is to withhold their work. Employers can say, okay, we'll give you more money, we'll give you less money, we'll give you better pensions, we'll give you less pension, we'll give you a savings account, you know, 401k, you can't have a savings account, we'll increase your health care benefits, we'll decrease your health care benefits, you can work more hours, fewer hours. Employers have thousands of things, that there are certainly hundreds easily, that they can use to negotiate, to manipulate, to alter the nature of the employment contract. Employees have only one thing, they can show up for work or not. And to forbid employees to strike is essentially the same thing as forbidding them to organize for all practical purposes, because if they can't strike, they have no tool that they can actually use to say, wait a minute, we're not going along with this. So I think that even essential services employees should have the right to strike, as they do in other countries. You see in France, you know, the police go on strike. Doctors went on strike in Canada last year, and they said that's it. Now, what they do when they do that is they make sure that, you know, there's not absolute chaos. Enough of them show up, or, you know, supervisory personnel show up or whatever. You know, they make sure things are, as PATCO was doing. PATCO had their strike organized in a way that air traffic was still flowing. You know, Reagan wasn't busting a strike in order to defend the travelers of America. He was busting a strike in order to bust a union. And
also, Tom, if I could just leave you a quick comment, because I know you've got other callers, is that, you know, a lot of people were calling on that station saying, you know, well, I work 14-hour days and I don't make that money. Why should they? And so my point was, and I don't know if you agree with this, is that, well, there's something wrong with the private industry. There's something
right.
wrong with your job. Why
you should make that. That's exactly right. And this is the meme. This is the frame, to use Jeffrey Feldman's language. This is the frame that the Republicans want to use, is that because we have a race to the bottom right now, being driven by increased payroll for CEOs and corporate profits, because of that race to the bottom, everybody should participate in the race to the bottom, including, you know, employees that have long-term contracts and good, strong unions. And, you know, we shouldn't buy it. We shouldn't allow them to sucker us into this stuff. You're absolutely right, Patricia. And we should simply say, oh, really? You think everybody should take, you know, should work for Walmart wages? What are we going to do? When everybody gets down to $5.15 an hour, then you'll be happy? No. It's wrong. It's fundamentally and foundationally wrong. Coming up next, Jeffrey Feldman with us from Frameshop is open.com. We'll be right back. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. By the way, I'll be filling in for Janine Garofalo and Sam Cedar in the Majority Report on Air America Radio for tonight, tomorrow, and Friday for the rest of this week. Just a heads up. Dear Mr. George Bush, President of the United States, for some time now I've been thinking, how can one justify the undeniable contradictions that exist in the international arena? These have prompted me to discuss some of the contradictions and questions in the hopes that I might bring about an opportunity to redress them. Can one be a follower of Jesus Christ, may peace be upon him, the great messenger of God, feel obligated to respect human rights, present liberalism as a civilization model, announce one's opposition to the proliferation of nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction, make war on terror his slogan, and finally work toward the establishment of a unified international community, a community that Christ and the virtuous of the earth will one day govern, but at the same time have countries attacked, the lives, reputations, and possessions of people destroyed, and on the slight chance of the criminals of a village, city, or convoy, for example, the entire village, city, or convoy is set ablaze. Or because of the possibility of the existence of WMDs in one country, it is occupied, around 100,000 people killed, its water sources, agriculture, and industry destroyed, close to 180,000 foreign troops put on the ground, the sanctity of private homes of citizens broken, and the country pushed back perhaps 50 years. At what price? Hundreds of billions of dollars spent from the treasury of one country and certain other countries, and tens of thousands of young men and women as occupation troops put in harm's way. On the pretext of the existence of WMDs, this great tragedy comes to engulf both the peoples of the occupied and the occupying country. And later it was revealed that no WMDs existed to begin with. Mr. President, you know that I am a great teacher. My students ask me how these actions can be reconciled with the values outlined at the beginning of this letter and duty to the tradition of Jesus Christ, the messenger of peace and forgiveness. There are prisoners in Guantanamo Bay who have not been tried, have no legal representation. Their families cannot see them. European investigators have confirmed the existence of secret prisons in Europe, too. And he goes on, this is the letter from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad to George W. Bush. Jeffrey Feldman is with us, frameshopisopen.com, his website. And Jeffrey, you're leading off frameshopisopen.com's lead frame with Iran grabs the spotlight, this letter from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, it's really quite an amazing letter. It's incredible to hear you read it. I mean, hearing it read out like that, it seems that President Mahmoud is trying to become almost the next Fidel Castro of our time. He's really appealing in these broad themes to a global audience by sending this, I think it was a 17-page letter.
Yeah, and in fact, speaking of Fidel Castro, he goes on to say, he says, lies were told in the Iraqi matter. What was the result? I have no doubt that telling lies is reprehensible in any culture and that you in America do not like to be lied to either. Don't Latin Americans have the right to ask why their elected governments are being opposed and coup leaders supported, or why they must constantly be threatened and live in fear?
It's incredible. It really is. And what I write about in the lead-off essay on Frameshop today is the idea that what appears to be probably one of the worst results to come out of the Iraq War, I mean, the clearest result is that after several years and billions of dollars being spent and thousands of lives lost, tens of thousands being ruined, the clearest result is a bold and empowered Iran. Here you have an example where the president of Iran really has been itching for the opportunity to play a starring role in this international drama where a key player in one region becomes David to the Goliath of the United States. And that's what he's done in this letter, by sending this letter, which apparently our government rejected, although they read it thoroughly, and leaked it strategically. Iran has made an incredible media move here. They've seized what I call the spotlight in this global drama and have now become key players on a global stage, exactly what we did not want.
Right, and this letter is being published in media organizations all over the world. I'm frankly rather astounded that the New York Times didn't bother to report it or to publish it in its entirety. They published some of Osama bin Laden's rants. And this is a, you know, while I'm not saluting Ahmadinejad for writing this, I agree with you that this is a carefully calculated, you know, appeal using religion and the intended. I haven't heard you say this, but I'm assuming this is your point, that he's writing this with the assumption that the listeners or the readers of importance are not going to be George Bush, but it's going to be the people of the world who are going to view him as a man of peace or something.
Exactly, and this appears to be the type of politics that that the president of Iran plays. I mean, these speeches in which he stands up and he condemns Israel and talks about, you know, Israel needing to be eliminated and having all Jews returned back to Europe. And these are speeches which are crafted to be heard by particular audiences outside of his particular local context. And in this case, this is a letter clearly intended for the United States public, which is divided on all these issues, and it speaks to Iran's ability to do research in the global media. And all the while, we have our government, the Republican government, trying to make a claim that they're somehow these backwards local tyrants who are itching to get a weapon in order to destroy the world, when in fact they are appear to be really crafty and intelligent manipulators of global public opinion through the very tools of the media that the Bush administration wants to be in control of but is slipping away from them.
Well, this is a major and powerful force in the Middle East, Iran. I mean, it's a country with a 1,000-year tradition. The Persians, they have, you know, their own unique language to their nation, Farsi. They have a culture that goes back a long way. They have the fourth or fifth largest reserves of oil in the world, according to Dick Cheney, the second largest reserves in the world. They're the fifth largest supplier of oil in the world. They have a huge and growing economy. They have a large middle class. They're a powerful and populous country, and to be the president of that is no small thing. You don't get to those kinds of positions by being the village bumpkin.
Absolutely, and seeing this Iraq war as an opportunity to really grab international spotlight,
yeah,
is not an amateur political move. And what's remarkable is that the Bush administration, rather than anticipating this type of move and finding ways to prevent Iran from grabbing the spotlight in this way, they have reverted to form. They are saber-rattling once again.
They walked right into it.
They walk right into it. It seems that they're going back through their file cabinet and pulling out old Xerox forms of, you know, how to start a war in the Middle East, and they're just changing, you know, one letter in Iraq to Iran, and they are doing it all over again, play acting in the United Nations as if they are serious about the United Nations, and all the while threatening to go beyond the United Nations. I just heard Condi Rice this morning in an interview saying that, you know, once again, they're going to go beyond the United Nations.
Yeah, and in the meantime, this in the, let's see, what is this? This is the Guardian. The Guardian in the UK, one of the British newspapers, the Iranian Mahmoud Ahmadinejad came out and said the U.S. Condemns nuclear activities, which they themselves are expanding day by day. They test the next brands of weapons of mass destruction every day. And then it follows. The Iranian leader's words came as the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, issued a veiled warning to the U.S. not to take military action against Iran over its nuclear program. And in fact, what Putin said was, methods of force rarely give the desired result, and often their consequences are even more terrible than the original threat. I mean, it's strong language. So what's the frame that Americans should be using to disempower Bush in his attempts to gin up another war in order to win elections in November?
Well, I think that, first of all, people need to talk about this idea of the president giving Iran the spotlight. I think that's a very basic idea there. That's
the frame that should be promoted.
Yeah, that's a very simple notion, and it's based on the metaphor of the Iraq war not necessarily being making the world safer, but the war being a theater performance, that metaphor, where the players in that region are making use of it for their own ends. That notion that the president is pushing, and it was just pushed in McClellan's press briefing yesterday, that the war is making the world safer. I mean, that's the idea that they're putting out there, and that the extension of that is the confrontation of dangerous people. In fact, it's not making anybody safer. All it's doing is providing opportunity, and the longer we're there, the more opportunity for this type of dramatic performance we are providing. And so we need, you know, I think that is an initial first frame, the idea of the war as a stage rather than something that is somehow suppressing danger. And from there, we need to talk about working again together with allies. I mean, this is a great lost discussion that's out there. The notion that we are once again trying to go it alone, no longer, you know, not listening to other people's advice, but walking right into another head-on, testosterone-filled confrontation between George Bush as some type of swashbuckling cowboy and his aides and the head of a foreign state. So we need to insist that we get back to a conversation about working with our allies, and that means taking seriously the United Nations, but also other people who are, in this moment, you know, Russia and other countries who are confronting us, but at the same time attempting to engage us to avoid the type of brinkmanship that led us into Iraq in the first place.
Yeah. In fact, there was a story in the British press day before yesterday that Putin... Was it Putin was talking about this is the equivalent of World War III or the beginning of the new Cold War. He said the Cold War is back.
Exactly.
And speaking about Bush's rhetoric, I mean, this is tragic. Jeffrey Feldman, you can read all about it over at frameshopisopen.com. One of the most brilliant geniuses of our day about framing and the whole psychological strategies here. Jeffrey, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Frameshopisopen.com. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We were so happy when they passed AFTA. We moved all our factories just across the border. We used to pay good wages, now we don't have to. Maquiladora. We'll pay you $50 for a 100-hour week. We'll bribe the inspectors so they can ignore you. You can't use the toilet and you're not allowed to speak. Maquiladora. The taxes in the states were sort of steep. The worker safety laws can really bore ya. Now we're turning out our products on the cheap at the Maquiladora.
And Maquiladora coming to a town near you. It's called the Bush Economy. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. For the latest iPods, all things Macintosh, all things computer, give them a call. Tell them Tom Hartman says hi. 22 minutes past the hour, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Let me just throw stuff at you and do what you like with it.
Okay.
I
have a question for you before you throw stuff at me.
Go on.
What's the deal with Hillary Clinton and Rupert Murdoch?
Well, the deal seems to be a mutual admiration society whereby he thinks that she has a good chance of being the next president of the United States. He knows where his bread's buttered, and so he's decided that rather than opposing her, he's going to some measure at least support her.
Just like he did with Tony Blair.
Right. She's not a fool. She'll take support anywhere she can get it.
Yeah. Yeah. So Rupert Murdoch, does he see himself as playing the role of kingmaker, or he just doesn't want to let this train go by without being at least on the back end of it?
I think both, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah,
okay.
I think both.
So you said you had a list.
Well, just a list. I mean, I've got Abramoff. I've got Jeb for president. I've got Lost Files. I've got the latest polls. I've also got Senators Clinton, as we speak of her, and Senator Harry Reid talking this morning about the Bush Enzi bill, which they say slashes away state guarantees for medical coverage.
It does.
And they're talking about how there are 6 million unintended pregnancies a year in this country, 3 million of which end in abortion, and they could slash that number.
By?
Half.
By doing what?
By passing instead a bill known as the, I'll have the name for you in just a moment, the Durbin-Lincoln bill, which would give the same kind of access to health care that members of Congress have, basically.
So women would have would be on birth control pills, for example.
They would be on birth control pills. They would have absolute access to birth control pills. They made the point that there is a two-tiered system of health coverage in this country. Women with money can get birth control. Women without money cannot, and yet we still have the absurd situation that Viagra is available to all. So you can get knocked up. That's widely available.
Right.
But to prevent getting knocked up is not available.
Right. It's nuts. And this Enzi bill, I believe it's Senate Bill 1955, isn't it?
You would know better than I because you are a policy wonk.
Okay. Well, in any case, the Enzi bill, if you call your senator and let him know, this is very toxic. Basically, what it says is that the state, if a state says that an insurance company must cover, for example, routine mammograms, and the insurance company decides that they don't want to pay for that because that increases their costs, then they can ignore state laws under the Enzi bill. And the Republicans are peddling this thing as, oh, it's going to reduce insurance premiums for small companies. Well, yeah, it might reduce them by $2 or $3 a year, but what it's going to do is massively increase the profits of health insurance companies, and at least over the short term, which is all that anybody seems to be interested in these days. I have a feeling they all know that national health care is on its way.
This coming at the same time, of course, as we've got the 15th of May deadline for signing up for the Medicare Drug Act. Basically,
right.
For seniors, for which, of course, there's a penalty if you don't sign up. I asked Senator Harry Reid if he could help me understand what reason the Republicans have for not giving an extension.
Mm-hmm.
Did he know of any reason?
Right.
And he said he just simply didn't understand it.
He had
no understanding at all.
As George W. Bush told a bunch of 80 and 90-year-olds yesterday, it's good to have, what did he say? Not closure on things. Good to have deadlines? No.
When you're 80 years old, you understand closure and deadlines quite well.
Yes. No, it was some phrase like that. I'm amazed it's...
condescending.
Yeah, it's just incredible. He said, no, we want to force people to recognize it. Now, there's also Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh has never been a judge before, not even a divorce court judge. And Karl Rove wants to put him on the appeals court in Washington, D.C., which is the court where if Karl Rove gets indicted, he will have his appeal heard. And Democrats push him back a little.
There's something extraordinarily sick about the fact that this actually could happen, that the indictment could happen this month, May, and that Kavanaugh's nomination could go forward. This was mentioned by Senator Reid as being of grave concern to him, but he didn't seem to be particularly encouraged to the extent of thinking that it will be stopped.
The Republican National Committee sent out a mass email this morning to everybody and their brother, including all the talk show hosts. I got it. The real Dem agenda.
You're on my list.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Next up on the real Dem agenda, obstruction. Democrats and liberal American Bar Association team up to obstruct highly qualified judicial nominee Brett Kavanaugh. They are hysterical about it. But this guy, you know, Brett Kavanaugh, he's an assistant lawyer in the White House counsel's office. I mean, he's never even had an independent job as a real lawyer.
He's perfect for Karl Rove, then.
That's right. I mean, you know, he and his job before that was working for Ken Starr, prosecuting Bill Clinton.
He's doubly qualified.
Yeah.
I don't know what your problem is.
Thank you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Great talking to you, Victoria. It's 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media is afraid of.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Son, you ain't the man doing her right. But I've been watching you and I don't lie. You've been treating my stars and stripes. Got too many fancy friends for me. The Saudis treat you like your royalty. You blew the budget. And you boss around. Now I'm taking my country back.
Oh, we're taking our country back, my friends.
Now I can understand why you were hot. Cause Bin Laden never did get caught. So you said we had Saddam to blame. Tried to tell us it was all the same. Now the years roll by. And our kids keep dying. You don't even have a plan to bring them home. Those WMD you promised on TV. Admit it, you figured it wrong. So I'm taking my
country. It's our We're Taking My Country Back segment. We asked Congressman Bernie Sanders some months ago, what can we best do? Activists out there all across the United States who want to help take back America. Should we give money to the Democratic Party, the Green Party, some independent? What should we do? And he said, find independent candidates, whether they be Republicans, Democrats, Independents, Greens, Libertarians, whatever, who really and truly represent your values and support those individual candidates. And our candidate for today, Rich Whitney. He's Whitney, the website Whitney, W-H-I-T-N-E-Y, 4-F-O-R, gov.org. And Rich Whitney running for the governor of Illinois on the Green ticket. Rich Whitney, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. How are you doing?
Just great, Rich. Great to have you here with us. Tell us about the race that you're running in.
Well, we're running, first of all, I should mention that we have to petition to get on the ballot, and we're in the midst of a huge petition drive. Illinois has one of the most restrictive ballot laws in the United States, and we have, in order to get on the ballot statewide, we have to get 25,000 valid petition signatures from registered voters in a 90-day window. But I'm pleased to announce we're well on the way. Our deadline is June 26th. We already have over 12,500 in hand, so it looks like we are going to get on. And so we're going to be posing a challenge to a DLC Democrat incumbent Governor Rod Blagojevich and a Republican challenger Judy Barr Topinka this November.
So, question here, Rich Whitney. Do you think it's possible that as a result of your candidacy in this race, Illinois could end up with a Republican governor? This is the question, of course, that's always asked Greens.
Anything's possible, but, you know, this is not like the situation in 2004 where I can understand where many progressives, you know, we're reluctant to vote green in the presidential race because, you know, we already had the fascistic administration of George Bush for 4 years, and there was a lot of fear. And actually, as you know, David Cobb and his campaign recognized that and ran, you know, kind of a campaign that acknowledged that. Here in Illinois, there's nothing to spoil. We have a governor, a Democratic governor, but he's not even well-liked by many in his own party. Because he has given us absolutely disastrous budgets. We have cuts in environmental programs, in the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Human and Family Services. people are very angry, and frankly, there is nothing to spoil. There's nothing to waste. People in this race can vote green and without having to worry about ending up with something worse than what we already have.
In other words, the Republican would be not that much different than the Democrat.
Yeah, exactly. The main difference is on budget issues, which is a big issue right here in Illinois. She's not even taking a position. She's kind of doing running on not being Rod Blagojevich as her main platform blank.
Really? The Republican candidate?
Yeah, the Republican candidate. It's almost like a reverse of what we've seen in some other races.
Yeah, yeah. So the progressive candidate in this race is Rich Whitney.
And that's it. Yeah, and, absolutely.
And the website, Whitney, W-H-I-T-N-E-Y, 4-F-O-R, gov, G-O-V, .org, Rich Whitney's gubernatorial candidacy for the state of Illinois. Rich, what can people from outside the state of Illinois do to help you obtain these signatures or help move your candidacy forward?
Well, as far as the petition drive, there's not much they can do unless, of course, they're interested in taking a trip to Chicago or elsewhere in Illinois before June 26. Then they can get in touch with the party and volunteer. And actually, we probably will have some volunteers coming in from Wisconsin and some neighboring states to help us out. But apart from that, the only assistance they give would be, you know, of course, a monetary donation. We're fighting big money, as we always do in the Green Party. Mr. Blagojevich has something like a $20 million war chest. He's already spending about $800,000 a week on TV ads.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it's
insane. Does he have any primary challengers?
He did, but the primary was held already, so he's passed that. So he's already begun a huge TV blitz, and as always, we in the Green Party are fighting that, but we stick to our principles. No corporate campaign money. We are trying to rebuild democracy from the grassroots up, and you know, it may be a harder row to hoe that way, but it's necessary if we're going to change the face of American politics.
Well said. We're talking with Rich Whitney. He's the candidate for governor in Illinois running on the green ticket, the website whitneyforgov.org. And, Rich, what would you, if you're elected governor of the great state of Illinois, what would be the first few things on your agenda?
Well, I'm campaigning on four main themes, and one of them, interestingly enough, is I'm making the Iraq War an issue in a state campaign. And the way I'm doing it is I have made a campaign promise to use the governor's power to veto any further mobilization of the Illinois National Guard for service in Iraq. And I've studied this question, and it may be a little bit controversial, but governors still do retain some legal authority to veto federal mobilizations under very limited circumstances.
Mobilizations of the National Guard or mobilizations of the regular army?
Mobilizations of the National Guard.
Okay.
And the reason I'm making a campaign issue, of course, is because, like the rest of the Green Party, we believe the war and occupation is illegal and immoral. It's flat wrong. And to put National Guardsmen into this combat situation, these kids who mainly signed up thinking they were going to get a little money for a college education, et cetera, and then to put them into this situation is just, you know, another part of the insanity of this war. Mm. And in the 1980s, there were some governors that attempted to stop National Guardsmen from being sent to Central America from their states, and it led to a court case involving Rudy Perpich, then the governor of Minnesota. And what Congress did is they passed another amendment that said, well, you cannot veto mobilization if you question the purpose of the overseas duty. So my attack around that is I'm going to challenge it on the grounds that it's illegal.
So rather than challenging the purpose, you're challenging the legality.
The legality and the morality of it, exactly. And frankly, I think the Nuremberg principles come into play here because, you know, this was a war that was a war of aggression, and I believe that, as any elected official should be doing today, that I have both a moral and a legal duty to refuse to send people over for service in an illegal war. And I'm not going to do it. Now, whether it will survive ultimately in the courts, I can't say. All I know is that I have to try.
Is that something, Rich Whitney, that you can do also not as governor through legal channels?
I'm not aware of any that allow us to do that. But, you know, the governor is the commander-in-chief of the Illinois National Guard. And I would intend to use every possible authority I have to resist further mobilization for service in an illegal war.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, you said that was one of four basic points in your platform.
Yeah.
What are the other three?
The second one is we need tax reform in Illinois in order to solve our budget crisis. Illinois has one of the most regressive tax systems in the United States. We're about the 46th in regressivity.
How so?
Well, part of it is because of our over-reliance on property taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is because the use of the sales tax, and we have a flat tax system that's mandated by the Constitution in Illinois.
Hmm.
So when you figure, and then there's all the usual tax breaks for corporations and corporate welfare. Well, when you actually add all the taxes together, the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy did a study, and they found that we are taxing in this state the lower and middle income class taxpayers at more than twice the rate of the top 1%. It's just totally insane. And then they wonder why we don't have enough money for our schools, for our colleges, for our social services, etc. And so one of the things that I'm campaigning for to straighten out this mess is a bill that would raise the income tax across the board, but would couple that with an earned income credit for lower and middle income class taxpayers.
This is a way of getting around the flat tax.
Exactly. It's a way of getting around the flat tax. There's a very good people's lobby here called the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. It's a union supported, and other public interest groups have gotten together to push this. And I'm the only candidate in this race that is actually campaigning for this tax reform.
That's great. We're talking to Rich Whitney. Rich, we just have a few seconds left. Your third and fourth points in a sentence.
A new deal for sustainable energy in Illinois that would be both job-creating and allow us to attack the problems of global warming and the end of the era of cheap oil, and universal health care through a single-payer system in the state of Illinois.
Oh, that's absolutely marvelous. People can learn more about it. Rich Whitney we're talking with. He's the Green Party candidate for governor in the state of Illinois. Right now they're engaged in a statewide campaign to gather enough signatures to get on the ballot. And if you can get there, you can help out. If you can't get there, you can send them some money. The website, whitneyforgov, whitneyforgov.org. Rich Whitney, good luck.
Tom, thank you so very much. I'm a longtime listener. I appreciate being on your show.
Thank you, Rich, and thanks for being with us today.
All
right, I appreciate
take care.
It. 45 minutes past the hour, the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, the time will come up when the winds will stop and the breeze will be cease to be breathing, like the stillness in the wind before the hurricane begins, the hour that the ship comes in. And the sea will split and the ships will hit, and the sands on the shoreline will be shaking, and the tide will sound and the waves will pound, and the morning will be breaking.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. We were speaking earlier about with Jeffrey Feldman about Iran and this letter from Mahmoud Ahmadinejad about basically saying to George W. Bush, hey, you know, we're both men of faith. Why don't we look to our religions and decide how we should be behaving? Now, my guess is that there's probably about 25% actual sincere, hey, I really believe this stuff in there, and 75%, this is a way to zing him. I mean, I just, you know, yeah, I don't know. And I don't think any of us do. And I doubt any of us ever will know to what extent Ahmadinejad is actually sincere in this letter. But you read the letter, and I encourage you to go out and get a copy of the English translation of Ahmadinejad's letter and just read it all the way through. It's very thought-provoking. Whether it's propaganda or whether it's straight up, it's very thought-provoking. And at the same time, and you know, and this is a guy, I mean, if it is true that he has called for the elimination of Israel, for example, then, you know, bluey, you know, he's lost all credibility with me. I mean, that's nonsense. But the nonetheless, the fact that he is the president of Iran and he might be reaching out to us to try and say, hey, let's avoid a war here. It could be a good thing, could be a bad thing, but whatever. One of our listeners just sent me a note. He says, I'm so glad you brought up the letter. I had the same reaction as you when I listened to Condi and the rest comment. I was disturbed, to put it mildly. He was reaching out to us in a way that cannot be construed in any way but positive, human to human. Now, that's where we have to be careful. This might be very carefully calculated whack job to whack job. I mean, it's just, we just don't know. Here's the thing that causes me to think that there's a plan B in all this. This from the Gulf Daily News, the voice of Bahrain. And why this is not in the U.S. papers, I don't know, but this is what's being reported in the Middle East. The Gulf Daily News, the voice of Bahrain, Dateline Tehran, Iran's oil ministry took a step toward establishing an oil trading market denominated in euros rather than the U.S. dollar by granting a license for the bourse, state-run television reported yesterday. And this is from Saturday's paper, so this would have been last Friday. Iranian television did not mention trading firms or governments willing to market or purchase products in the bourse, nor did it say when it would open for business. Iran, this is what the broadcast said, beginning and end of it, Iran has registered an oil bourse on the island of Kish in which oil would be sold in euros. The market would be the fifth oil market after New York, London, Singapore, and Tokyo. Oil trading on those markets is conducted in dollars. And I would add to this, by the way, and this is not in the story, that Norway, which is one of the leading oil producers in the world, has talked about setting up an oil bourse to trade oil in euros as well. Now, why would Norway be interested in that? Why, for that matter, would Iran be interested in that? Well, because, in part, the U.S. dollar, relative to the euro, has fallen something like 18% this year. I mean, you look at the dollar, and it's just going through the floor. I mean, you look at the long term. Over the last 90 years, the dollar has lost 98% of its purchasing power in 90 years. That's pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. But if you compare it to other currencies and you look at what's going on, you look at natural resources, I mean, it's really, frankly, just quite striking how all of this is going on. The Canadian dollar is going up. The Australian dollar is going up. It looks like the New Zealand dollar is about the only one that's going down. The euro is going up. I mean, all of this stuff relative to the dollar here. The Canadian dollar is at a 15-year high. This from the Aiden Forecast, by the way. Aiden, A-D-E-N, research, AidenForecast.com. They're recommending buying euros and Canadian dollars. It's very, very, wow. I mean, if you had $10,000 and you put it in euros, the euro rises, you make a profit. I mean, it's just that simple. And Warren Buffett, as I shared with you yesterday, the second richest man in the world behind Bill Gates, is saying, I'm getting out of dollars. Sitting in $45 billion worth of dollars, and he's getting out of dollars. So I would submit to you that the reason why gold went above $700 in the last 24 hours, I guess it's back down below 700 right now, but the reason why gold is exploding, the reason why stocks and bonds are up 4.5%, bonds are down 15%, gold has gained 28% this year, silver 51%, copper up 66%, platinum up 23%, zinc up 77%, nickel up 51%, oil up 10%. I would say that none of these things are actually up, that what's going on is that the dollar is going down. In fact, if you look at the $850 high of gold back in the 1980s, and you factor in inflation, gold would have to hit $2,000 to just be exactly where it was in late 1979, early 1980. And I don't think that that's impossible. In fact, I frankly think that's probable. So, and at the same time, George W. Bush is out there spending $2.5 billion a day more than he has. You look at somebody who's spending more than they have constantly, and you say, there's a real problem here. There's a real problem here. And, is our country standing on the brink of some kind of economic disaster? I am increasingly concerned that we are, and that if we don't do something politically to get these absolutely irresponsible people out of office, which is, by and large, the Republican Party and the DLC Democrats, to get them out of office and replace them with people who are going to look back at what FDR did and say, you know, yes, let's be practical, let's be pragmatic, let's try what works and let's reject what doesn't work and let's move this country forward. We're going to be facing some very difficult times. We're not going to be handing off a better world to our children and our grandchildren. And that's not right. It's just not right. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, so much in the... It is amazing. What is going on in the world today? The Democrats opposing the GOP on the health coverage bill. This is... It's really amazing how this is being spun, this thing. There are the Senate Republicans. This is Mike Enzi's little gift to the world. I believe it is Senate Bill 1955. That's from memory from yesterday. And oddly enough, the article that I have here does not have the legislation number in it, but I'll just keep an eye on the chat room here. I know somebody will pop it up for me. Senate Democrats threatened yesterday to filibuster Republican-backed legislation they said would scale back health insurance for millions. This from The Guardian in the UK. Yes, they report on American News. Republicans said the measure would allow small businesses to offer coverage to more workers. Right, right. Yeah. In fact, Mike Enzi, he says this is something that small businesses have been asking for almost 15 years. Yeah. The bottom line is that what this bill says is that if a state requires something like, say, for example, mammograms, then insurance companies can say, nah, we don't have to pay attention to that. Mike Enzi says, his aides, rather, say they'll support some mandated coverage if a majority of the states require it. For example, 49 states require the coverage of mammograms, so they'd be allowed to continue that coverage. Yeah, right. As Lillo in the chat room notes, Tom, haven't you noticed that Republican legislation always favors small business? Right. Yeah. Under the current bill, this is incredible. Critics also say the Enzi bill would allow insurers to charge higher premiums to businesses with sicker, older workers than businesses with younger, healthier workers. Under the current bill, the variation could be as great as 26 to 1, meaning some small businesses could be charged premiums 26 times that of another business. Now, I don't know what small businesses are paying for health insurance these days all across the United States. I haven't done a comprehensive survey, but I do remember just a year ago in Vermont running my own small business and paying for health insurance for our employees, which was, you know, basically Louise and me, the small business being the show, and we were buying it through a group through the local Chamber of Commerce. And it was like $800-$900 a month, as I recall. I mean, it was an incredible amount of money. So according to this bill, the health insurance company, if let's say it's $1,000 a month, because the average amount that is spent per worker in the United States is a little over $10,500 per year. So, you know, $12,000 a year would be $1,000 a month. Let's just round it up to $1,000 a month. Yeah, Senate Bill 1955, the Health Insurance Marketplace Modernization and Affordability Act. Thank you, Sue, in the chat room. Sue Nethercutt, who just does such a wonderful job of running our chat room there. Under the let's say it's $1,000 a month. The health insurance companies could say to an employer that happens to have, say, an employee with MS or an employee who has a number of children, or an employee who has a child who has a disability of some sort that's rather expensive, they could say to that employer, that small employer, well, you know, you're driving up the cost of the risk for your group. You're going to have to pay 26 times what everybody else pays. Everybody else pays $1,000 a month. You're going to have to pay $26,000 a month for the insurance for your employees, courtesy of the Republicans in the Senate. Isn't this sweet? There's a story in the Oregonian this morning about how Senator Gordon Smith, who in here in Oregon, portrays him, likes to portray himself as the moderate, right? I mean, this guy is a moderate. Well, he's just not a moderate. I mean, what can I say? If Gordon Smith is a moderate, then I'm a frog. And in any case, he's like, well, I'm not sure if I'm going to be opposed to this bill or not. I say, what? The Republicans marching in lockstep, by and large, on this thing. It's basically just a total effort to jack up the profits for the health insurance industry. And I'm telling you, the health insurance industry is doing the same thing the tobacco industry was doing 10, 15 years ago. They're doing the same thing that the oil industry has been doing for the last 6 or 8 years. They're doing the exact same thing that the prescription drug industry has been doing ever since the Republicans came into office. They're all looking down the road and saying, you know, more regulation is eventually going to come because what we're doing is damn near criminal, and so we're going to squeeze every penny we can out of this thing. The health insurance companies, of course, concerned about national health care. If the president and the president's party were to simply say, and this could be done very easily, I would suggest to you, if a progressive Democrat was elected president and progressive Democrats were put into the House and Senate, or Greens, or independents who are progressive, like Bernie Sanders, if progressives were in charge of this country, the president could very easily say, as Harry Truman did, only he had to deal with a Republican House and a Republican Senate at the time in 1947, could simply say, okay, this Medicare program that we have that right now covers just old people, this Medicare program is now going to cover everybody, cradle to grave, everybody. Everybody's taxes are going to go up a little bit. Everybody's coverage goes to 100%. Or 95% with a copay, so that, the tip of the hat to the free market folks who want to say, well, if you got to pay a little for it, you won't use it as much. Although, frankly, I have never in my life, in my 50-plus years on this planet, I have never in my life met somebody who thinks it's a fun thing to go to the doctor. I've never met anybody who says, gee, Thursday is open, and I'm kind of bored. I think I'll go in for a colonoscopy. Or, I've got an available day on Tuesday. Let's go in and have a mammogram. Or let's go in and let's get a brain scan done. That sounds like fun. How about a barium X-ray? I want them to stick a needle in me and pull some blood out. That sounds like a lot of fun. No, I've never met anybody like that. I realize there's a small number of people who actually have a mental illness. You know, who are just over the top, flat out, full blown hypochondriacs, or even worse than that, they actually like hanging out in hospitals. There's a small percentage of those people. But you identify those people. I mean, they become pretty obvious fairly early on. Why should all the rest of us be harmed because the system has not figured out how to take it? Well, actually, the system has figured out how to do it. Every country in the world knows how to deal with this stuff. And Americans are sitting around going, well, how can we do this? Gee, I don't know. How can we do this? I don't know. And meanwhile, the House and Senate conservatives have agreed on a $70 billion borrowing from you and me, our children and our grandchildren. They're going to borrow $70 billion to make sure that people who earn their living by having a check arrive in the mail from their investments, sort of like Dick Cheney. The people who earn their living on, you know, what's called passive income from investments, from dividends and capital gains, that those people never pay more than a 15% maximum income tax rate. They're going to borrow $70 billion in the name of our children and our grandchildren. This is how much chutzpah these guys have got. They still, 5 years in, this discredited tax break system, this whole corrupt, broken system. George Bush coming along saying, oh, you know, if we just, well, it's, here he is, actually.
$1 billion with a robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief. We will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Yeah, isn't that great? Let's give out $550,000 per job, and good times will come. And as Craig Paul Roberts pointed out yesterday in the piece that I was sharing with you, those jobs didn't appear, the good times didn't appear. We're 7 million jobs down from what we need just to keep track with the growth of population. And why is it that the unemployment numbers aren't higher? Well, because a lot of people have just given up looking when you're on the unemployment. Actually, they're probably still looking. It's just that officially, when you've been looking for a job for 18 months, they no longer count you as unemployed in that 19th month and thereafter. So the GOP, the Republicans, the conservatives and the among the Republicans, they don't even need a single Democrat for this thing because they control a majority in the House and Senate. They expect to have this thing on Bush's desk on Friday so that he can sign it Friday so it'll get lost in the news cycle. Nobody will pay much attention to it. The multimillionaire commentators on TV, the guys like, you know, Matt Lauer with his $14 million contract to ask tough questions of the ExxonMobil chairman. Yeah, right. They're probably not going to squawk too much. After all, they're looking forward to living on the dividend checks when they retire. Yeah, I just don't think you're going to hear much about this in the media, frankly. That what the Republicans have done over the last 5 years is they have carved out a new category of taxpayer and said these people will never pay more than 15% income tax if you earn your living from investments. Whereas if you earn your living from the work that you do, hey, get in line and pay like the rest of us. And they're going to push this thing back another 2 years. Right now it expires in 2008. They're going to make it expire in 2010. 16 minutes past the hour. Viagra for your brain.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Friends, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Larry Scott's with us, the editor-in-chief, chief cook and bottle washer over at vawatchdog.org. And Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again. Just got my latest email here from GOP.com going through here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, these are great. See, I'm supposed to hold a house party. And if I have one of the 10 most successful, I can win a first-of-its-kind GOP iPod.
Wow! How come you're getting that and I'm not? I sent them $5 this year.
Boy, I tell you, I've got to know what these folks are doing, so what? I get all the emails.
Did you send them $10?
Hmm?
Did you send them $10?
No. That's... Actually, I just signed up for it.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder if they took me off the list. I haven't gotten one from the. I haven't gotten one of those fundraising thingies in probably 2-3 months. Ever since I started talking about it on the air, that's what's happened.
That could be. This one's from Michael Duhaime, the RNC political director.
Yeah. No. What I'm getting, the one I got this morning was about Brett Kavanaugh, and it's the one that goes out to all the talk show hosts.
Right.
You know, this is the, here are your talking points for the day. That's interesting.
Well,
I'm going to have to go over to rnc.org and sign up again.
Actually, it comes from GOP.com is where you want to go to, and you can sign up for their mailing list. And it's rather interesting information here. Let me see. Just a second. Ah, there's the delete button. Okay.
Your computer is once again clean. Praise the Lord. It's clean.
It's been purged.
Larry Scott with VAWatchdog.org. Larry, what's the story here? I noticed the lead story over at VAWatchdog.org is about the former head of the Veterans Administration. And we discussed this last week, your allegation that he's been up to no good. Tell me about this.
Well, there were allegations in a series of articles in the L.A. Times that Anthony J. Principe, who is president of a company called QTC, and he had that before he came to the VA. Then he was VA secretary for the first 4 years of the Bush administration. Then he went back to QTC last year. There's allegations of wrongdoing. QTC is a company that provides disability examinations, not only for the VA, but for workman's comp, for private doctors, for private business, and so forth. The L.A. Times started digging and found out that Principe's firm is to benefit to the tune of about $1.2 billion in VA contracts. they think there's some wrongdoing there. And the latest story this morning is that Principe's firm is not sitting about quietly. They're firing back. And they have literally dissected the L.A. Times article and point by point, sentence by sentence, offered rebuttals to the L.A. Times information. So it's very interesting. There are some ongoing investigations in Congress right now. The latest was Thursday and Friday. There was some very, very hurry-up testimony before the Democratic and Republican councils who work with the House Veterans Affairs Committee, and they're trying to piece together information. Was there any wrongdoing? And basically, it was kind of preliminary testimony. That testimony then will be forwarded to the chairman of the committee, who's Representative Steve Bowyer of Indiana, who will then make a decision as to whether or not they have enough information to go forward with a full investigation. So they're looking at it, quite frankly. My contacts in Washington right now tell me that Representative Bowyer will probably take the 2 days of hurry-up testimony and say, nope, not enough information here, and it'll go away.
Yeah, in other words,
that's what it looks like.
Another show trial, kind of, or not even a show trial. Another burial.
Right, and the interesting thing was the testimony was called for at the last minute. I know one of the attorneys who represents veterans, who was called to testify. They called him Thursday morning and said, "We need your testimony. We're going to call you back at 5 o'clock. Put you on the speakerphone. Be ready to testify." And this came completely out of the blue. I mean, he had no concept, so he was hurrying all day Thursday to get his paperwork together. And the feeling is, the rumbling is, that the so-called testimony or hurry-up testimony will just be taken and shunted aside and said, nope, nothing here. Yeah. Disregard the man behind the curtain.
Yeah. Surprise.
Yeah, no big surprise there.
There you go. Okay, we have just a minute to go here. We're talking with Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. Principe's, not predecessor, the guy who's followed him, multimillionaire home builder, Jim Nicholson.
Yeah, Jim Nicholson. There's a great article that just came out in Colorado Biz magazine that really explains to the readers what a powerful person, not only financially but politically, the current VA Secretary, Jim Nicholson, actually it's R. James Nicholson, is. From humble beginnings to West Point man, multi-millionaire land developer and home builder, he was chairman of the Republican National Committee, ambassador to the Vatican, and now VA Secretary. But this is a man who has used every step in his life as a political stepping stone. He is considered one of the most powerful people in the state of Colorado and also one of the most politically powerful and influential people in the entire United States of America. And for your listeners, Tom, if they have any inkling at all about what's going on in the VA politically, read the article. It's great.
Fascinating. And where do you think he's going to go from here, in a word?
I couldn't tell you, but I don't think it's going to be down.
Yeah, so governor of Colorado or something like that. Who knows?
He's already exploring that. It will be at least governor, if not a senator.
Amazing. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the VA being used for political gain once again, or economic gain. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It's a glad you got nothing to feel. It's a glad their thoughts so real. Hey, baby, somebody shine on me. Lay down.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 34 minutes past the hour. And time now for our Catherine Harris Alert.
Well, if we make this coat, it would be as if I were wearing your dog.
Yes, indeed. On the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, Catherine Harris battles old friends for Florida's keys. Despite roll in 2000 recount, her Senate bid is souring. Jeb Bush speaks bluntly. Catherine Harris, the article by John D. McKinnon. Catherine Harris, overseer of the Florida recount that tipped the presidency to George W. Bush, is gunning for U.S. Senate seat, but instead of gratefully supporting her, the Republican establishment just wishes she'd go away. Democrats are having a field day with the candidate's entanglement in a Washington lobbying scandal, as well as her uneven political touch. She once made a speech about a terrorist plot that didn't exist. Democrat incumbent Bill Nelson in the polls. Oh, she's badly trailing Democrat incumbent Bill Nelson in the polls. A slew of staffers have quit her campaign, frustrated by her management style and her tendency to ignore their advice. In particular, the suggestion that she forget the whole thing. They've quit because she didn't take their advice. Took a quit! Florida Governor Jeb Bush, the president's brother, told reporters at a recent press briefing that he warned Ms. Harris about becoming a distraction given the high degree of animus that still surrounds her. The campaign can't be about her, Governor Bush said. I have given her that exact advice since then. It's gotten worse. Now, the Bush is actually trying to talk State House Speaker Alan Bentz into running for the Republican nomination. The filing deadline is Friday. So we'll see. By the end of the week, the Republicans in Florida are supporting somebody other than Catherine Harris. I respectfully disagree, responds Ms. Harris, 49 years old, who is currently a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. Clearly, at the beginning of the year, she's referring to Jeb Bush, said I could win. Last month, he said we could turn it around, and we've done that. Yeah. So, anyway, that's our Catherine Harris alert for the day, and a fine one it is. Among other alerts for the day, time now for a Limbaugh alert. Boy, they just keep coming, don't they?
Condescending tribes making money selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts. I'm offensive, I'm bigot, I'm fraud, can you dig it? I'm sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am.
Because I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class because I'm a fat conservative butthead with the face of a horse's ass.
He's a fat conservative butthead. Hey, with the face of a horse's ass.
Yes, indeed. Our Limbaugh alert for the day, our Rush alert for the day. Limbaugh saying, well, those folks in New Orleans, after all, they were liberals. Of course they should be drowning, right?
We were all stunned because New Orleans has been run by Democrats. Louisiana has been run by Democrats for decades. Liberal Democrats to boot. New Orleans should have been a utopia. Opposite. We had a microcosm, a model of exactly what unchecked liberalism does. It creates destitution. It creates hopelessness. It creates a mess. It's such a mess they couldn't even save some of the people who were there and get them out of town, even though they had the mechanism and the advance warning to do it.
Now, the last I looked, the mess was actually caused by a hurricane. I didn't know that hurricanes had political agendas or political affiliations, but the last I looked, that mess was caused by a hurricane. And the last testimony I heard from both the governor of the state of Louisiana and people inside FEMA was that FEMA had said to the governor and to the mayor, don't use your school buses. We're sending buses. And then FEMA never got around to sending them. So, what can you say? Well, it's just another Limbaugh alert, of course. You know,
in closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the copper, the cop, the Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-of-the-mouth, jack-booted slob, the democratic trasher, years of liberal bashing with the equivalent compassion of a grommet. With the IQ of a pig, I'm the fat, obnoxious pig. And the truth of the matter is, I'm vomit. Because I'm a Nazi.
Heil!
I really am.
Because I'm a Nazi.
Heil!
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class. Because I'm fear-mongering scumbag with the face of a horse's ass.
Yes. And I mean, more positive news. For those of you who saw the bird flu movie last night, that was a spooky movie, I got to tell you. Although apparently it didn't do all that well. Drudge raving today about how they came in with a 4.1 share, which basically means very few people watched it. But the movie, the title of the movie was Fatal Contact, Bird Flu in America, ABC made-for-TV movie. It's actually a pretty good movie. I watched it this morning before we came in to do the program and recorded it last night. And it was pretty scary. But one of the things that many people are concerned about that may be driving this whole bird flu thing, and speaking as a guy who lives on a house that floats in the middle of a river, and I this morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, which is when I get up in the morning, it was 3:30 by the time I got around to maybe 3:15. I went out of the back deck, beautiful dark starry night. Go out and for my morning oblations, you know, to just spend some time out there looking up at the sky and muttering a few words. And on the back of our deck, Mama Goose, Papa Goose, and three little baby geese, goslings, little yellow fluffy things. They've been around for about a week, recently hatched. And they're sitting there on the back deck, Canadian geese, on the back of my house. And Mom is pretending she's asleep, and the babies are looking at me curious, but they didn't make the noise they usually do during the day. You know, they have an instinct. They know not to say, I'm here. So there's none of the beep, 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 cheep, cheep, cheep. But Dad sticks his head way up, and he leans toward me and goes, this hiss, you know, if you've never been hissed at by a goose, you've missed an important part of life. In any case, I stood there for a few minutes, and he calmed down and just kind of went back to sleep. We feed them from time to time so that he's used to us. And looking at him and thinking, boy, you guys could be bringing the bird flu to me. I mean, after watching this movie, I'm looking at geese sitting on my back deck going, you know, maybe it's time to encourage somebody else to feed the geese, you know. So anyhow, one of the other things that concerns people about this whole bird flu thing is that it may have some relationship as well to global warming. The global warming may be expanding the habitats of disease areas and may be also making some of the very northern lakes that they are now concerned may be reservoirs for this virus, more hospitable as reservoirs for this virus. So to tie that all together, Vice President Al Gore, this Antonio Rigaldo writing in today's Wall Street Journal, he notes that Vice President Al Gore is pulling together an educational group and intends to spend millions of dollars convincing Americans that global warming is an urgent problem. Now, here's what's really interesting about this. The people that he's pulled together for this thing, and it's called the Alliance for Climate Protection. He has Lee Thomas. Now, the name may not be very familiar to you because the last time Lee M. Thomas was a high-profile guy was back in the second term of the Reagan administration, you know, 84 to 88. Lee Thomas was the head of the EPA, the Republican head of the EPA. He's agreed to be a board member on this thing. Carol Browner, that's a name that may be a little more familiar, a little more recent. She was the head of the EPA under Bill Clinton. Here's one that's a real eyebrow raiser. The guy who was writing op-ed pieces in the New York Times, as I recall, before we invaded Iraq, saying, please don't invade Iraq, Mr. Bush. It wouldn't be a good idea. You'll be in there forever. It'll be a disaster. It'll be a morass. The guy who many people think was writing those press releases or those stories, rather, those op-ed pieces, on behalf of George Herbert Walker Bush, warning his son not to make the mistake of following the neocons into Iraq. Brent Scowcroft, a former national security advisor to Bush Sr., is going to be on the board of directors of this organization. Initial funding for the effort will come from projects, writes Rigaldo in the journal, will come from projects run by Mr. Gore, which include An Unconventional Truth, a film documentary starring him, Mr. Gore, slated for release by Viacom, ahead of Memorial Day in New York and Los Angeles. And he's also donating an advance, which is reported to be $250,000, he received from Rodale on a paperback about global warming. Hey, Rodale published one of my books, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. We got to talk to them about the advances we get. Actually, okay, I'm not the vice president. I know that. And here's another one. A fellow who's a managing director at Lehman Brothers, also going to be the co-chairman of the alliance. The co-chairman, along with Al Gore. His name? Theodore Roosevelt IV. Teddy Roosevelt IV and Al Gore putting this organization together, and they're going to get out there and they're going to start campaigning. They're just saying, hey, we have a serious problem. As Teddy Roosevelt IV, Theodore Roosevelt IV said, there is a recognition. We are getting much closer to serious adverse consequences. He's the great-grandson of the conservationist Republican president of the same name. It's amazing. Al Gore pulling together a group of Republicans, by and large, one Democrat on this list, for the Alliance for Climate Protection. And this is a totally bipartisan thing. Al Gore, man, if this guy would run for president, I would do just about anything I could to help make him, you know, within reason and within the law, to get him elected. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We bang the drum slowly and play the fife lowly. You know the song in my heart. In the turning of twilight, in the shadows of moonlight, you can show me a new place to start. I've turned my clothes and I've drained the cup, stepping away at it all, thinking of you. When the sun comes up, when teardrops fall.
And welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our quote for the day from Abraham Lincoln. The probability that we may fail in the struggle. And he was speaking about literally a life and death struggle, not just for himself and the many people who were supporting him, but for the nation. The probability that we may fail in the struggle ought not to deter us from the support of a cause we believe to be just. I guess you could paraphrase that for the Bushies as the probability that we can make a whole lot of money and get ourselves more political power should encourage us in a support of a cause that we know is not just, but we can fool some of the people some of the time, and maybe we can fool all of the people some of the time, and hopefully the some of the time will continue until we get out of office. Tragically, the news from Iraq today, as we wrap up the program here, just with the best of the news. And by the way, for those of you who have the means, I'll be on the air for another 3 hours this afternoon from whatever time it plays in your local market on the Majority Report on Air America Radio, today, Thursday, and Friday. A suicide, Talifar, Dateline Talifar, Iraq. Talifar, keep in mind, this is the city that George W. Bush cited as the success. This was his success story. Remember the Marines rolled in there and they took out the terrorists and killed a whole bunch of people. And he says, okay, we've got this city pacified. Now, keep in mind, after World War II, the Germans and the Japanese, who fought us literally all over the planet in a war that led to the deaths of tens of millions, not one American soldier was killed in Germany or Japan during the occupation. My father was a member of the occupation forces in Japan. And they literally were greeted with flowers. But in Iraq, you know, when the neocons come in and they take your country over and they say, hey, we're going to give you the economy that the conservatives know is the way things should be. We're going to give you a flat tax of 15%. We're going to allow any corporation to bring in as many laborers as they want. We don't care what kind of labor force you have in the country. We'll ruin the whole thing. And they have. We'll take your natural resources. We'll build military bases. We're going to take your best land and build a 21-building, 104-acre complex on it. Call it a U.S. embassy. It'll be the U.S. headquarters for the planet, for the empire. Somehow it reminds me of New York having been perceived as the new York. York being a major city in the British Empire. Back in 1774, the Brits thought of New York as their outpost, their empire outpost in another part of the world. And we kicked their butts down the street pretty effectively. Tragically, Bush and his buddies, the Republicans in Congress, his enablers, the House of Representatives, the Senate, and in particular, Bush's enablers on ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, MSNBC, the AP, right across the board in the media. All these people who sat and just sat and grinned during these press conferences, who never asked a hard question, who to this day don't ask hard questions. I mean, it takes Stephen Colbert to point out the hypocrisy of the press corps. As a consequence of this, Tal Afar, Bush's success story in Iraq, Dateline Tal Afar, a suicide bomber killed 24 people and wounded 35 yesterday when he blew his car up in a market in the northern city of Tal Afar, police said on Wednesday, raising the death toll from 17 to 24. A hospital source said the casualties included civilians as well as Iraqi police and troops. The U.S. military said on Wednesday the explosion killed at least 16 Iraqi civilians and wounded 134 other people. Bakhaba. Gunmen killed 11 people while they were heading to their work at an electrical equipment factory near Bakhaba, 65 kilometers northeast of Baghdad, Lieutenant Colonel Salman al-Dalaghi of the Iraqi police said. Police had earlier given a different version of the incident, saying seven people were killed when a booby-trapped car exploded. Dalaghi said the initial report was based on an erroneous witness statement. Bakhaba, again, Dateline Bakhaba, a gunman killed Lieutenant Colonel Kane Hassan, an aide to the head of Bakhaba's Criminal Intelligence Directorate, along with two bodyguards while he was heading to work in the city. Another story, Dateline Bakhaba, a policeman and a civilian were wounded when a roadside bomb went off near a police patrol in Bakhaba. And in Baghdad, gunman shot dead an employee of the Ministry of Defense in southwest Baghdad. Oh, and here in Hawaji, an army major and two soldiers were seriously wounded when a roadside bomb went off near their patrol in Hawaji, 70 kilometers southwest of Kirkuk, police said. Meanwhile, Iraq's parliament convened to work on a law regulating the assembly's work. It was the legislators' second normal session since it was elected in December. Let us hope that the legislature of Iraq can actually get their act together, that these guys can pull this thing together, and they can take over their country, and we can get out of there. Even if it means that they develop a strategic alliance with Iran, even we have to become energy independent. I mean, it's just crazy to say that the future of our country depends on our being able to take oil from the Middle East and control it with the cost of our military. Your tax dollars right now are paying for the gasoline at the pump by way of protecting the supplies of the oil and the tankers. And we're not even seeing that part of it. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, actor and activist Ed Asner tomorrow will be here speaking out about the impeachment of Bush. Lester Brown dropping in about his new book, Plan B 2.0. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman program. Remember, my friends, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.